And that's because the people at the very top who sit in their ivory tower and they call the shots, they have their own agenda in mind. So, for example, somebody calls the police for support, call it a domestic incident. Say, for example, you have an argument with your partner. The officers who will turn up to that incident will try and do their best. They'll speak to you, they'll speak to you, they'll speak to your partner. If at any point you, well, more than likely, if at any point your partner says, yeah, you know, we had a bit of an argument. At some point, I got a little bit nervous, a little bit scared because, yeah, you know, it got a bit out of hand. I don't want him locked up. I don't want to make a complaint or anything like that. You've never been in trouble with the police before. You're not known to the police whatsoever. That officer then has to contact their supervisor, who isn't there, and they go in. There's no incident here. There's no crime. It's a standard argument which has just gotten a little bit out of control. But what we're finding is because of statistic chasing, those officers are then being forced to put handcuffs on people. So when they make that arrest, they have no accountability over that case then. So they don't need to make contact with the victim. Basically, they lock up and they drop off and then that's their job done. Because cops are now being graded on how many arrests that they complete. Right. They're being targeted with their stop searches, their arrests, the traffic stops, their intelligence report. Now, if you've got a supervisor breathing down your neck saying, okay, there might not be any crime here, or need to take positive action, so therefore you need to arrest somebody. Being arrested can have a massive impact on somebody's life, to the point where I've even been told people have ended their lives because of the amount of stress it's taken on them when they've been on bail. So can you trust the police? You can trust the officer in front of you to have a moral compass, but a lot of the time, the decisions what they are there to make, the decisions what they make are taken out of their hands by a supervisor that isn't even in the room. They're being forced to make decisions which they don't want to do. And that completely destroys the morale of the officer. And it completely destroys the service to the public, the faith in the police. And it also means that when things do get out of hand and you really do need the police, you see the police as a punitive service rather than one to support you. It means that victim support is through the toilet. It means that perpetrators and offenders are getting away with it, but the police look good because they've got so many extra stats in there, so many extra stats being ticked. So then they can say, and particularly when it comes to cases of domestic violence, they can put forward a case and go, we take positive action against violence against women, for example. Because we're not looking at the actual result of whether someone gets convicted. We're not looking at the result of what happens post-arrest. We just see it as we've had a 20% increase in arrests.
Well, it's mind-blowing to think that police officers are arresting people based on a stats report, mm-hmm. when we know that crime is through the roof now because it's become, well, completely unmanageable. The police are outnumbered, God knows how many to one. And when you think of all the severe crimes, now I'm not watering down domestic violence mm-hmm. at all, and I know that you're just giving me one example mm-hmm. and there's probably many, many more. And our job as human beings, not just officers, is to make sure our women and children are safe. And that starts within the household. But
welcome to Pod Summarizer. Visit our website and summarize your favorites podcasts.
I get the example you've given. But it blows my mind that there's so much crime that they don't need to be nicking people for stats. The crime's out there for the taking. All you've got to do is open your eyes and police properly mm-hmm. without fear or favour. This is my opinion from what I've seen anyway. But we're talking sort of big, I mean, domestic violence is, you know, it's also as serious as it gets. That will have long-term effects, as we both know. But what about burglaries and rapes and knife crime and murders and grooming and gang raping mm-hmm. and top tier drug dealing and human trafficking? I mean, there's enough to go round. You don't need to be. So they're going for the low hanging fruit to get their stats. Is that what we're saying?
So if a police force is measured by detections, for example, so does a crime have a positive outcome? And this is why I feel that there's, in my opinion, why there's so much emphasis on online crimes now, on hate crimes. Because if you need to present, if you need to present cases to the Home Office and say, these are our detections, and you've only got so many resources to go around, are you going to focus on a rape which is labour-intensive for a detective? It is very difficult to prove because there's not a lot of third-party evidence in a rape. A lot of rapes happen by someone you know. It could be an inter-family rape. It could be a domestic rape. Not often it's, say, like a... When we think of a rape, we think of like a stranger rape, someone being dragged into some bushes, that sort of thing. It's generally quite rare that that happens. When it comes to things such as sexual assaults, burglaries, they're a lot more resource intensive, require a lot more time and effort and officer manpower to actually deal with that. But if you've got a hate crime, you've got somebody said this nasty thing to me online. Okay, well, the evidence is right there in front of you. And the thing with a hate crime is if somebody at any point throughout the evidential chain, doesn't even have to be the victim, doesn't have to be the perpetrator of said crime. If anybody during that investigation at all says this is a hate crime, it then becomes a hate crime. And there's a lot of emphasis put on those hate crimes. For example, just going back to my thing when it comes to domestic violence, in order to get a domestic violence incident closed, it had to go to a inspector. So you have a constable, then you have a sergeant, then you have an inspector. So you have to go two ranks above. The only other crime where I'm aware of that is applicable is a hate crime. So they're almost putting the same severity on domestic terrorism, which can lead to homicide, as a nasty Facebook message which somebody deems as being hateful. And again, it's completely subjective. Now, in answer to your question, why do they seem to focus so much on these crimes over here and not these crimes? It's all about how the police force is measured. If it's all about the police force is measured via the outcomes, the arrests, the detections, you're going to go for the easier incidents rather than the more labour-intensive ones. Police are outnumbered so many to one. We are hemorrhaging officers, absolutely hemorrhaging officers. The Police Federation have put something out recently saying up to, they believe, 10,000 officers a year are going to be willfully resigning. 10,000 cops a year saying, I've had enough. The amount of messages I get every day saying, I'm hanging up my handcuffs, I'm done. And it's rarely because of an incident they've been to. Of course, there's the effect of cumulative trauma, which needs to be can't be understated. But the main reason why people leave is because of the organisation itself. It's because of the leadership. It's the people that are in these positions of power implementing and pushing down their own rhetoric and their own agenda, which then the officers have to execute, which again leads back to that. I don't feel like I'm doing the right thing. I'm arresting somebody for something which they shouldn't be arrested for. My autonomy of my decision-making is taken out of my hands. So that's why so many cops are leaving. And on the front end, they're struggling to recruit officers as well. So in my old force, the population of the town I worked in had about 250,000 to 300,000 people. How many officers do you think were available at any time to answer a 999 call for a population of 300,000 people?
As the discussion around police staffing challenges deepens, the focus shifts to how these issues manifest in real-world situations, particularly during protests. In the next segment, the speakers delve into the complex dynamics of police interactions with protesters and the implications of perceived biases in law enforcement.
So I've seen the police ferry them in, mollycoddle them, be very kind to them and protective when they don't need to be. And then I had an incident recently where I put my hand out to shake an officer's hand at a protest to thank him for keeping law and order, because I appreciate you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't at the moment. Mm-hmm. And he refused to shake my hand. I've said this a couple of times before, but I'll say it again because I'm not anti-police. I actually feel sorry. I think police officers at the moment are victims of the police institution. Mm-hmm. But still, if I put my hand out to shake someone's hand and I feel like we're supposed to be on the same team and he's got his arms crossed saying we don't need to shake hands, it really, really upset me.
Yeah, yeah.
What would you have done in that situation? You're at a protest and you've got people protesting against migrant hotels, you've got counter-protesters, you've got the police in the middle trying to balance it out, and then someone that's been perfectly friendly comes up and says, you know, thanks for what you're doing. Would you have shook their hand or would you have said, oh, we don't need to shake hands?
It's a hard one because I have shaken people's hands before. You know, when someone goes, thank you for your work. Yeah, okay, that's fine. In a situation like that, though, it can be considered quite a politically charged movement. You know, you've got the right side, you've got the left side. The police aren't allowed to show political favour. Even though that's very clear that happens, is it from an organisational level? Organisationally, it's okay, well, it almost looks like we will support this movement, but go against this movement or be more firm against this movement. In that situation, I don't think I would have shaken your hand. Not because I don't like you or I was disrespectful toward yourself. It's a case of my supervisor looking over my shoulder. And if I go to shake somebody's hand at a political event, that can be seen as me showing political favour to somebody else. So I can understand both perspectives. I can understand your perspective of going, I just wanted to thank you for a good job. And the upset that that caused and the sense of bias as to why they didn't shake the hand. But I can also understand the officer's perspective, where he's going, if I shake your hand, as much as I might want to, if I shake your hand, I can then get hauled over the coals for showing political favour one way or another. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. So you as a human being, as an individual, you wouldn't have shook my hand. So I'll ask you the question to play devil's advocate. Would you have shaken any counter-protesters' hands if they had come up and said, thanks for doing a good job?
No, because then you're a hypocrite, aren't you? You can't say, oh, let's, you know, you are clearly representing this side of the argument. I will shake your hand and all the rest of it. But then this side of the argument, I'm not going to shake your hand and say I'm politically unbiased. You would have to have that stability of opinion for both sides. You would have to remain independent, regardless of who's in front of you. So, no, if I made a decision not to shake your hand, that means I can't or won't shake anyone else's hand because I don't want to show, like I said, political favour to somebody else.
Now, being completely impartial, I respect that. It's like, okay, I understand your predicament. Mm-hmm. But what triggered me was the fact that for the last 2 years, well, in fact, for a lot longer than that, and you can tell me if you've seen this or not as well, I've seen a two-tier policing system on steroids. So where I've seen the police cozy up to people on the left, shall we say, or it's good versus bad at the moment. It's not right versus left. It's all completely. But where I've seen the police cozy up to counter-protesters, agitators, real far left-leaning lunatics, unnecessary liberals, I sort of think, well, OK, if let's see which way you swing. Thanks. OK, so you're not going to shake my hand, but we've seen on the news for God knows how many years that you're arresting people that are protesting against genuine causes with genuine concern, but you're going in with kid gloves on the counter-protesters that turn up wearing masks. Yeah. So that was my frustration, was the fact that I've seen two-tier policing for so many years now. I mean, the last 2 years, it's just been, I think it's undeniable. What would you say?
You can't deny two-tier policing doesn't exist. Now, I want to caveat that. When it comes to the officer on the ground, it isn't a case of you're getting a radio message saying, I mean, say that, I'll tell you a story now. So when researching my next book called The System's Fucked, I have spoken to loads of police officers. And I've always asked a question to them, does two-tier policing exist on like the frontline level? 99% have said no. We're not being directed to arrest someone based off skin colour or ethnicity or, you know, cultural sensitivities. But there was one who said they were at a petrol station and there was a white Eastern European male and then I believe it was a Muslim Asian male as well. What happened was them two got into an argument. It was the Muslim gentleman who started the argument and the officer on the scene relayed this to their sergeant asking for advice, like both kicking off. I believe this guy started it. What's your advice? And they said, lock up the white European because that will cause less cultural tensions. That's the only example I've heard of that happening on the front line. My own experience, I haven't not arrested someone due to political ideology or cultural sensitivities. If you've done something wrong, you're coming in, if I can justify it, irrespective of where you may sit. On a organisation level, we can't deny that two-tier policing doesn't exist because, like you've said, kid gloves for one, more robust for the other. Dancing at Pride, not happy to shake somebody's hand at a United Kingdom rally. But I also believe that, I think it was Northamptonshire Police have been recently taken to court about their activity at Pride because they were taking part in Pride, but then there was a counter-protest and they weren't taking part in that one, so it clearly shows a political divide there. Mm. And I believe they were then taken to court to say, well, you can't do that. The police have to be apolitical. The courts, on the other hand, 100% politically captured, 100%. We just have to look at the Southport riots. We just have to look at when it comes to hate crimes, when it comes to incitement to violence, incitement to cause damage. Somebody posting a tweet gets immediate custodial sentence, which, by the way, to remand somebody with no PNC record is fucking impossible. I've been on the phone to a CPS lawyer before at 2 a.m. saying, like, this guy's going to go out and he's going to kill his missus, or this person's Joey drug dealer and he's just going to go out, he's going to flee the country or whatever. No, well, we don't want to remand him. We think he'll be all right on tag, or we think, bail work. So when I heard that a certain individual posted something on X and then was remanded in custody. I'm like, that just does not happen. Why on earth has that happened? And then when we look at the sentencing, because of course, like we know, like I mentioned before, man who strangles his partner, suspended sentence. Somebody posts something online, immediate custodial sentence. Immediate. And the guilty plea as well. The courts are massively politically captured. I believe that in the higher rungs of the police, depending on the ideology of that superintendent, that assistant chief constable, that then feeds downwards, which then reflects on how the attention is when it comes to officers on the ground.
Having explored the grim realities of policing and the pressures officers face, listener insights now shift towards the emotional toll experienced by those in the force. The next segment delves into personal stories of trauma, resilience, and how such experiences affect mental health both on and off the job.
It's getting in there somehow, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Even with that wall up.
Yeah. And even though you might not deal with it there and then, it's still, you might then wake up with, you know, having night terrors. You might find your alcohol use is going up a little bit more. You're not being able to sleep properly. You might be getting a bit more snack. That's all just signs of PTSD with things, with the accumulative trauma of what you've dealt with. And I remember one night, me and my girlfriend were having a beer. It was like a Friday night, something like that. I was having a beer and just watching TV. And the next thing I know, my head is in my hands and I'm just crying my eyes out. It was just like, for some reason, it all just went, it all just overflowed. And she was an absolute star to me. She proper looked after me. And it was just that relief. So, I mean, I've struggled with my mental health. I've struggled with my mental health before I joined the police due to stuff that's happened to me in early childhood. But I have absolutely struggled with it during the police as well. And this is when we talk about the welfare side of it. So the police can put on and say, we have these welfare days and we have this welfare truck and everything else. But the best welfare support I ever got was, I just said to my sergeant one day, I said, you know, that job that hanging man went to the other day. Yeah, I didn't keep thinking about it and just went, right, okay. He put his radio down, just went, right, come on, back room. I was thinking, fucking hell, I said something wrong here. And he literally sat here like this, me and him, and we just went, had a chat for 15 minutes. And that was all I needed, just that one-on-one.
Vent.
Just that vent. And we just was open and honest about, because he came to the incident as well. And we had a chat about it. And that was great. That human touch, that human talk with somebody. When I was arrested and then over a malicious allegation, I was arrested and then I was released. I had, once all that was finished, I had counselling and occupational health support. That was really good. The worst I ever felt was when I was in an abusive relationship myself. And this is why I got so, I don't know, so passionate about domestic violence and looking at men who get wrongly accused, and why I saw so much injustice when I was seeing men who, frankly, have been arrested because they're men and because the police have this agenda of positive action to arrest somebody because they have all the quotas and everything else. And I was seeing so many guys being lifted and having their lives ruined, which should never have been in that position in the first place, because I've been through it. Because it happened to me. So I was in a very abusive relationship for like 6 or 7 months. And I know it doesn't sound like a lot, but 6 or 7 months in that environment, it feels like years. My ex-partner attacked me. I defended myself and I called the police. So I'm there covered in blood. I contacted the police and they said, girlfriend's just attacked me. I've had to whip her back to get her to stop. I'm now calling you for help. They said, well, what's she doing now? They said, well, she's in the kitchen. She's calmed down. Oh, we're not coming then. Sorry. Oh, what do you mean you're not coming? I'm calling you for help. I'm bleeding. Why are you not? Oh, okay. So then I had to kick her out of the house myself, and that was the last time I ever saw her. I then called the police 4 times over the space of 24 hours, asking for help. They didn't come. I was then, the next day, I was in work, in the police, and I was arrested at work. Because she had called and made a counter allegation. They hadn't even gone to see her. Off the back of a phone call, they deemed he's the one in the wrong. We need to arrest him. 12 hours in the cell later, put on bail. It was all, after a couple of months, it was NFA'd. The Crown Prosecution Service and their paperwork actually said, why was he arrested when we can clearly see he's the victim? We've got all of his statement. We've got all of what he said on interview. We've got all his injuries. We've got the phone call. And it all goes against, the evidence we have goes against her. Why was he arrested? Oh, blatant sexism. And I sued the force for wrongful arrest in the end. But in that couple of period of, in that period of time, I'm thinking, am I going to get convicted for this? I've not done anything wrong. I've looked after myself, which I'm legally allowed to do. There's a myriad of other incidents which have happened where I've been assaulted repeatedly and I've not reported them. I'm now looking at the social services that then involve my family and my son. Am I going to lose my job? All these, it's a thing you wake up to in the morning and you think about it all day until you go to bed at night. So having been through it myself, and mate, I was fucking suicidal. I was on the verge, you know. And thankfully, you know, a good support network around me and everything was fine. Definitely the worst I've ever felt in my life. And all the injustice around it as well, because she never got convicted. She never got convicted for anything what she did. So there's that side of it as well. But then I'm then expected to go and do a job where I'm seeing people who are in my position, who I do not believe have warranted the police involvement whatsoever. And you're asking me to now try and convict this person. And I think that was a big moral shift for me. Because I've been on the other side of the cell door. And I've spoken to people who deal with prisoners, deal with suspects, people on bail, who have told me that as a result of this lock somebody up, because it's a stat, leave them on bail for months, people are ending their lives because the families are absolutely turned against them. They lose their jobs. They can, you know, family relationship breakdown. The stigma as well of people thinking you're a domestic abuser. There's nothing worse than somebody who hits the partner.
Why didn't you walk away before it got to a stage where you had to hit her back?
As in the relationship in general?
Well, there'll be mixed reviews on this one. Mm-hmm. You could be in the eye of the storm and you've got a woman attacking you. You can turn around and you can walk out and just leave that space, or you stand your ground and then you react and you hit the woman back. Obviously, there's a lot of men out there that just would always say, walk before you raise your hand. But it's very easier said than done. When you're in the eye of the storm and you've got somebody coming at you, you know, there may not be a door near you. So I don't know the scenario. But so, yeah, I'm just curious as to why you hit her back instead of just walk out the door.
I mean, he was one of them. She was like a feral animal. It was the only way I could get her to stop. Mm. And I'm not proud that I had to do that, because I've never hit a woman in my life. I'm not proud I had to do that. And, you know, sometimes I do get a comment saying, oh, well, you're a domestic abuser. I'm not. And I'm in a happy relationship now. I've been in for, God knows, you know, several years, and never so much as an argument. It was a case of, that was the only way that I could make this person stop attacking me. This person threatened to stab me before. They'd thrown hot water in my face. They'd thrown cups in my head. They'd push me. It was an incredibly volatile relationship. And I'm not a psychiatrist, but I strongly suspect that the person I was in the relationship with, in my opinion, had some kind of personality disorder, whether that was borderline personality disorder or whether that was NPD, narcissistic personality disorder. But even if they didn't, what they did and how they treated me was still not okay.
That's all for today. Visit podsummarizer.xyz and start creating summaries of your own podcast in just seconds. Don't miss it.